Good morning. It's a joy to be speaking up here with you all again. My name is John, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm the intern here at Edgewood Church. Almost a year ago, I was introduced to Edgewood while I was serving as a camp director for Passport Kids in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. At camp, I had the privilege of meeting Joy and some of the youth here. And when Joy told me about Edgewood, I was immediately intrigued. You see, I was in the midst of questioning a lot about faith, action, and the church. I wondered if the models of churches I was familiar with was actually having an impact on communities and encouraging people to live in a better relationship with each other and with the people outside of the church. And I asked if the church is actually accomplishing what God intended if it has no impact outside of the church. And maybe that's a bold question to ask right before starting seminary. Or maybe it's the right question to ask. But since coming to Edgewood and seeing how this place serves the community, I feel like I'm starting to piece together a better understanding of what church has the potential to be. God subverted my expectations of what church is and what it means to be a part of a community. And as a result, my perspective shifted as well. And I think that's something that God does really well, is subverting our expectations. This morning, we're going to be talking about how the prophet Elijah expected God to act and how God actually acted and subverted those expectations and really took care of Elijah during a time of need. So our story takes place during the 9th century BCE. The kingdom of Israel, once united under King Solomon, has split into two, with Israel in the north and Judah in the south. At the risk of sounding like I'm explaining background information for Game of Thrones, I'm going to provide some context for who is in the story and why they act the way that they do. So buckle up. So the king of Israel during this story is Ahab. And Ahab is the son of Omri. Now what Omri did when he was king was expand the territory of Israel in the north. And what he also did while doing that was encourage the building of local temples and altars to the deities of the places that he conquered. Now, this is a common tactic used by conquerors such as Alexander. And they do this because when you take over a group of people, if you let them practice some of their culture, they're going to be a little bit less mad at you. So they did this and encouraged other people to continue in whatever they're worshiping to decrease the chance of a rebellion. And the strategy worked. The policy created some political and economic stability for Israel, except that the prophets and their followers did not think so. So Ahab's wife is named Jezebel, and she's a Phoenician princess who is a follower of Canaanite gods, such as Baal and Asherah. And she encouraged the building of these temples and brought with her, when she came to Israel, a whole bunch of priests and prophets of these Canaanite gods. Baal is a title that simply means Lord. And it was applied to a variety of Canaanite gods in the Hebrew Bible, but it is used in 1 Kings to refer to a god of storms and the weather. Now, the sponsorship of other gods by Ahab is a source of a lot of tension within the community. And it's in the midst of this political turmoil and drama that Elijah appears onto the scene. Now, Elijah's name literally means, "My God is Yahweh," which is very fitting for what's about to happen. So in typical prophet fashion, Elijah storms onto the scene and he admonishes the ruler of Israel for turning away from Yahweh. And Elijah challenges Baal on behalf of Yahweh, which implies a challenge to the mixing of these two cultures. Now I want to mention something that Joy said a few weeks ago, that it's kind of hard to understand the morality and ethics in a lot of these stories in the Hebrew Bible. Sometimes there are things that happen that we don't agree with, and I think that these stories are useful when we can wrestle with them and think about what it means for us rather than blindly accepting and following the morality that's in place in here, because there are things like genocide and other things like that that's placed within a context of people that were going through a lot of hardship and with different nations conquering them and trying to persevere, and that's the context that these texts came up. So if we were to take them and say to blindly follow it rather than wrestle with these and see what's kind of bubbling beneath the surface, we can really get a lot out of that. So back to our story, a contest is held between the prophets of both nations. And here's how this contest works. So both sides set up an altar and they place an offering on it. In this case, it's a bull. In ancient cultures of the Near East, where this story takes place, it's the aroma of the offering that is accepted by the gods. So basically, whoever has the best smelling barbecue is going to win this contest. Now, the catch of this contest is that no one can actually light the offering on fire. The god has to do it. So Baal is the god of storms and weather. So this seems like it would be in his territory, right? So they've got the altars, they've gathered the nations in front of them, and the followers of Baal and Asherah, they go first. And so they're praying and they're crying out for hours and hours, and nothing is happening. And Elijah is in rare form during this contest, and he is mocking them, he's making fun of them, he says things like, "Where's your God? Is he asleep? Go wake him up. Maybe he's using the bathroom." All kinds of stuff just to taunt them, and nothing works. They're not able to light this thing on fire. Then Elijah, to rub salt into the wound, gets a bunch of water and douses the entire thing, his altar, in water, including the bowl. It even says in chapter 18 that water was pouring out of this thing, so it's totally drenched. And then he prays, and immediately it's lit up on fire. And so Elijah wins, Yahweh wins, Israel is proven to be victorious, right? So everything is going well. But after winning, the contest takes a drastic turn when Elijah orders the killing of all of the Canaanite prophets, totaling 850 deaths. And Queen Jezebel is understandably furious, and she basically says, "I'm going to do what you did to them within 24 hours. And so he runs away into the wilderness. In the wilderness, Elijah is quickly depressed. He leaves his servant, and he travels alone by himself. He tells God that he is no better than his ancestors and that he wishes to die. This section of the story follows a model that's familiar to those who have read about the Israelites and their journey in Exodus. Certain themes such as wandering through the wilderness, divine provisions, and a revelation of God are common to the story of Israelites as they traveled the same land that Elijah is going through. So the sudden shift in Elijah's mood might come as a shock to the reader. Elijah did what he set out to do. God had his back, and he was clearly victorious, and so was Yahweh. So why does he feel this way? One apparent reason for his depression could be that he was scared that Jezebel was going to come after him and kill him like she said she would. Or perhaps he was feeling some kind of guilt for ordering the death of so many people after making such a big spectacle out of it. But clearly God was looking out for Elijah by granting Elijah the fire for the burnt offering. Yet Elijah remained scared. In the midst of this depression, God sends food and water and allows Elijah to rest. God does not tell Elijah to get over it or to have more faith or that he should be grateful for what he has. Elijah expresses his emotions, as complex and painful as they are, and God responds with what Elijah needed most: food, water, and rest. A professor of spiritual care once told my class that when someone is in the midst of a crisis, advice and information are often overrated, because in the midst of their pain, it's hard to see beyond their own perspective. How many of us have been in this position? I find that when I'm feeling like this, the most helpful thing is not someone telling me all the reasons why I shouldn't be sad, and it's not another person telling me that I should get over it, or me telling myself that there's other people that have it so much worse than me, so I just need to get over it. That isn't that helpful, even if that might be true. It's just not going to be the thing that's going to help me to get over that. What is most helpful is the loving presence of another person and taking care of the physical needs of the body with food, rest, and comfort. God provides exactly what Elijah needs and gives us a healthy way of taking care of ourselves when we are feeling like Elijah does. So when God does this for Elijah, Elijah is rejuvenated. He wakes up and feels well enough to travel to Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. For 40 days and 40 nights he travels. This is another reference to the Exodus. Horeb is a very important mountain to the Israelites. It's the same mountain where Moses received the Ten Commandments, and Elijah is the only other person in the Hebrew Bible to have a theophany here, and a theophany means a vision of God. So this is a very holy place, and it's important that this is the specific location that Elijah goes to. When he gets to the mountain, God asks Elijah, "What are you doing here?" And Elijah starts by saying that he has done everything right according to the Lord. He has been committed, he has done what God has commanded, but bad things are happening and he is scared. Ironically, he mentions that the Israelite prophets are being put to the sword and that he's next. And he's unable to see that. He did the exact same thing to the followers of Baal, but he's terrified that that's going to happen to him. And it's another example of sometimes how our own anguish keeps us from seeing a perspective beyond our own. And it is in this moment that God is revealed to Elijah. Just as God passed in front of Moses on this mountain, God passes in front of Elijah. This is the culmination of Elijah's entire journey. Up until this point, the power of God has been displayed in tangible and physical ways. God out-controlled the weather in front of the God of weather by summoning a fire so powerful that it burnt up an offering that was soaked in water. Elijah has seen God's might and power, so he's expecting God to reveal God's self in a way that is mighty and powerful. We expect God to act in certain ways that benefit us based on our understanding of who and what God is. If God only did what we expected God to do and never subverted our expectations, I feel that our lives would have more bias, judgment, and suffering. Author Anne Lamott put it well when she said, "You can safely assume that you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people that you do." The way that God is revealed to Elijah is powerful, but it's subtle. God starts by summoning a powerful wind that rips the mountain apart in front of Elijah. But Elijah sees that God is not in that wind. Then an earthquake appears, and it's followed by a fire, and God is in neither of those things. God controls the weather in the scene, which is another diss towards Baal. But God is not manifested in these signs. Elijah is witnessing all of this and expecting God to appear as one of these mighty signs. And the thing is, Elijah has devoted his entire life to being a prophet and listening to God. So if anyone has a good guess as to how God is going to act, it would be a prophet, right? But we see that his guess was off the mark. It is in the stillness that follows these events that God is revealed. The presence of God is still, it is quiet, and it's kind of intimate. It's described as a whisper. After the revelation, God shows Elijah a plan, one that involves appointing new rulers and a new prophet who can continue God's work after Elijah. God opens Elijah to new possibilities that help him to see past his own situation and past his own suffering. So far, Elijah has been thinking of himself. It's been his God, his pain, his life, his sadness, his suffering, his safety. God reveals to Elijah what is true in all of our lives, that there is truth beyond our perspectives, and there's truth beyond our definitions of what and how God is supposed to act. God, of course, is conscious of this, but Elijah is not. And I think we bounce back and forth between these two perspectives of being so immersed in our own views and ideas, and we switch towards seeing the big picture. And I think spiritual practice gives us the strength to hold both of these things at the same time. Psychologist and spiritual teacher Ram Dass described it as having one eye looking up at heaven and one eye on the ground below you. So what does this mean? Well, it depends on who you ask. Some historical scholars will say that God's quiet presence in the background is a metaphor for the change that's about to come in the politics of Israel. Rather than a violent overthrow of Ahab, symbolized by the earthquake, wind, and fire, not the band, God will make subtle political moves to get the right person on the throne behind the scenes, like a quiet, still whisper. That's pretty cool. But mystics might say that God is ever present because all sound arises from silence, and if God is in the silence, God is in the background of everything. That's pretty cool too. But I'm not sure which interpretation is correct, or if there is a correct interpretation, but I feel that this is a story that can reshape our understanding of how God works. God cannot be anticipated, predicted, or systematized as much as we might want that to be the case. However, God is with us in our grief and in our pain. Just as God provided food and rest to Elijah, God provides for us, often in simple and practical ways that we don't expect. When we find ourselves in situations beyond our control, it's easy to be afraid, and it's okay to be afraid. God is with us in the midst of our pain. When we are so caught up in our situation that we can't see past our own suffering and our own perspective, God offers us chances to see things differently. The hard part is that we have to keep trying in the midst of that pain. We have to be open to receiving the incredible gift of new insight, new perspectives, and new understanding and empathy that God offers to us every day. There are things that we can do to make us more open to receiving these things, such as talking to a professional about what we're going through, or taking medication that helps us to get through the difficult things that we're facing. But God is with us and watching over us, as with Elijah. But we have to take initiative to see beyond what we think we know. God works in ways beyond our understanding, but at the same time, God cares deeply about how we feel and addresses those feelings in ways that we don't often anticipate. God subverts our expectations in order to pull us into a place of compassion, understanding, and action by showing us a path through our suffering. God is the loving, still, and quiet presence accompanying us in the midst of our suffering. Let's pray.